And so in these ordinances that municipalities began to actually adopt in Pennsylvania, they said to themselves, how do we fight off this corporate assault by Walmart Corporation or by Monsanto Corporation or by the Walmart, you know, the Waste Management Corporation or Synagro? How do we fight these assaults off, and how do we become more effective in doing so? And it made sense to them to begin to recognize another basis of rights, rights on behalf of ecosystems and natural communities within their region and within their municipality, that they could enforce to stop the corporate assault from coming in the first place. Because what became very clear to them was that their own rights weren't doing the trick, because it was very clear that corporate rights were overriding the rights of their communities. So it made sense in a very practical way to give birth and recognize this concept that ecosystems had certain rights, because then they could enforce those rights to stop the corporate assault from coming into the communities. In October of 2006, a little place called Tamaqua Borough in a little county called Schuylkill County in Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, passed the first Rights of Nature Ordinance. It's binding law in the borough of Tamaqua. It declares that ecosystems and natural communities have a right to exist and flourish. And then it provides enforcement remedies, not just by the municipality, but also by community individuals who automatically have standing to sue on behalf of those natural systems for enforcement and compensation. Today, five municipalities in Pennsylvania have passed those laws, those rights of nature ordinances. We're looking for a test case right now. I think we found one, which is a stream that flows through one of the communities that has a rights of nature ordinance in it. And that stream is being impacted by activities next door. And we think that may be the perfect place to bring a rights of nature challenge under the ordinance to try to begin to enforce these ordinances. About 20,000 people in Pennsylvania are now living in communities in which those rights of nature ordinances have been adopted. Finally, to close up today, people ask about what the big picture is. That's what folks want to know. We teach these things called democracy schools across the United States. They're three-day training sessions for lawyers, municipal officials, activists, and community leaders. In effect, critically examining the regulatory system as the basis of environmental law. I mean, I don't think it comes, it probably won't come as a surprise to most folks in this room, but 40 years after beginning the environmental movement, which really wasn't a movement at all, because what we refer to as the environmental movement has never sought to drive rights of nature into fundamental governing frameworks. Movements in this country are about driving rights, about the suffragists driving the 19th Amendment into the Constitution, the abolitionists driving the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments into the Constitution. Movements are about driving rights into the Constitution. The environmental movement that we have today, which has been regulatory in nature, has never sought to drive rights for nature into any fundamental governing frameworks. So when I go out and speak, sometimes it gets me in trouble, that I say outright that there has never been an environmental movement in the United States, because it's never been about rights. That today, after doing work for 40 years in the regulatory arena, after creating an alphabet soup of regulatory agencies, after creating NEPA and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, after 40 years of people doing courageous work on the front lines to enforce that regulatory system, today, by almost every measurable statistic, things are worse today than they were 40 years ago. Right? It's not about condemning the work. It's about saying that the work has not worked, and that it's time to reframe the whole system of law and jurisprudence that has clothed this area to make us think that the regulatory system is about environmental protection, when in reality, it's about regulating how quickly we destroy the ecosystems upon which we depend. It's about orderly destruction. That's what the regulatory system is about. And so I get hope from these communities in Pennsylvania where you would least expect perhaps this type of work happening. You may expect it from the Sierra Club or from urban areas or from liberal progressive activists who are moving forward to do this work. These are not those folks. These are rural conservative folks who it makes sense to begin to build a new system of law. The big picture stuff is about now in Pennsylvania writing new constitutions. We've moved beyond ordinances, and we now have something in Pennsylvania called home rule, which allows communities to begin drafting their own constitutions. Those constitutions at the local level, which are ratified by majorities, allow us to take the ordinances that we've drafted and constitutionalize them into a higher form of law. In essence, It's not just about being disobedient and creative, but it's also about taking on what we refer to as a property and commerce constitution. In other words, we have a U.S. Constitution at this point that has things like the Interstate Commerce Clause in it that allow corporations to override communities when they attempt to control or regulate anything that can be defined as commerce. We have corporations with Bill of Rights protections, which allow them to overturn ordinances and laws passed by community majorities. In essence, we have a U.S. Constitution which is grounded in English common law, which comes out of the worst period of time in England, as England was becoming an empire. And it places the rights of property and commerce above the rights of people, communities, and nature. It is the hardwiring and the DNA which is in place, which guarantees that our community groups, all those years that we were working with those community groups, were never going to get what they wanted. It was the hardwiring that prevented them from getting there. The big picture stuff in Pennsylvania means 500 to 1,000 communities moving forward to draft their own binding local constitutions that give, that recognize rights of nature, that expand the rights of people and communities, and finally begin to confront the hardwiring and DNA of this country, which in essence is about putting property and commerce over the rights of nature, people, and communities. Thank you.
Tom Lindsay of CELDEF, CELDF.org. A few questions from the audience followed. The first questioner asked Lindsay whether he was coordinating the movement nationally and what was happening in other states.
It's an excellent question. There are little pockets. In fact, I'm on the road for the next 6 months or so visiting some of those pockets. Just to give you a very quick thumbnail, in a little place called Barnstead, New Hampshire, for example, we worked with the community to ban corporate water withdrawals. Nestle Corporation, some of the other bottling companies are active in New Hampshire. It's a very rich aquifer, a lot of water, to, for example, suck 300,000 gallons of water out per day for bottling operations and then ship it to Europe. I mean, that's the plan in parts of New Hampshire. And so one community has arisen, Barnstead, and by town meeting, from a vote of 122-1, became the first in the United States to pass an ordinance banning corporations from withdrawing water and also refusing to recognize those corporations having constitutional rights and protections within the municipality. Just off the top of my head, really quick, New Hampshire is one place where there's a little pocket that's formed. In Virginia, you had 1,000 people surround a county courthouse with the county demanding that the county supervisors pass an ordinance that banned corporate sludge dumping in rural Virginia. You have things happening in Washington State, a little pocket beginning to emerge in California, and in Ohio, we've had two organizers working for a little while to try to get something going there. So it's the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, and the rights of nature stuff is really like the cutting edge of the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, and people in other places are beginning to work through this process. Generally, the way we do it is with democracy schools. We have graduates coming out of the democracy schools who we then pair with and work with to try to get organizing campaigns on the ground, because to us it's all about the community organizing, and it's about how to drive this stuff into binding law rather than doing non-binding resolutions or those types of things, because it's the binding law passage that draws the response from the state and from the corporations that automatically organizes the community for you. Because a lot of this work is about decolonizing people's brains, because we think that we have a democracy in this country, but in reality the structure of law means we don't. And so coming to grips with that is really difficult for some folks. The rights of nature stuff means automatically that we have to come to those conclusions, because unless community majorities are set free to actually begin making decisions on sustainability, we won't be able to get that stuff driven into law either.
The next comment was from a lawyer who questioned the rights-based strategy.
Nature being treated as property. In other words, the way the system of law is set up is that property under the structure of law has the highest and best afforded protections. That's how the Constitution is written. That's the English common law stuff that has come out. It's been popular with progressive liberal thinkers over the past 2 years to start talking about nature as the commons. And I really rebel at that, because when we use the word commons, we mean common property. So it's almost as if we had a slave that was once owned by a slave master and now is owned by the community, that makes everything okay. So it's, you know, common property instead of privately held. And so I think it's, even though it's easy to go in that direction, to grab onto being afforded the highest and best protection of the property, that in this case, when we treat nature as property, which we have for the last 3,000 years, not under our jurisprudence, but others, that we run right into the brick wall because it puts us in that position. As for, you know, I guess I've gone through an evolution of my own. In the beginning, I thought that the way to solve these problems was to get the best thinkers in a room and then figure out what the solution was and then program communities to actually carry out the solution. And I've seen that not work in so many places, and plus it's so anti-democratic that it's a new organizing model that's developed where we go in, not just us but others, and ask people what they want as a community and then say and tell them that we're there to help them get it. Because I think its basis is about problem solving. And my final comment is, it's not about law at all. This is not a legal problem that we're facing. This is an organizing and political and ethics and cultural dilemma that we're facing. And so what we're looking at in Pennsylvania, and I don't want to scare the crowd, but in Pennsylvania, when you have an ordinance being passed by a local municipality, and they're talking about rights, and they're talking about all the good stuff that they've been talking about, and a federal court comes in at the behest of Monsanto Corporation, using their corporate constitutional rights, which are illegitimate in the first place under our structure of law. It's a more complicated conversation, but corporations having constitutional rights is something that, under our structure of law, that they possess, but it's illegitimate because governments are set up to protect rights, not deny them, and here they've given rights to corporations which are now being used to deny our rights. It goes back to the American Revolution, well-settled black-letter law, that when a federal court comes in and issues an order and says it is so ordered that the Monsanto Corporation's rights as a corporation are more than your rights as a community, that there has to be a disobeying of the court's order, right? And so that piece of paper has to be ignored by the community, okay? And we're getting to, you know, because otherwise we will always be at the behest of institutions that are enforcing a minority system of law through the corporations against majorities. That's the system of law that we're in. And so if we accept the ruling, and we accept a legislature that sticks the Attorney General onto municipal governments in Pennsylvania, we will never get to a earth jurisprudence, we will never get to community majority decision making, and we will never get to vindication of democracy. And so those are the types of things that I think have to happen. But as lawyers, we are pretty much extraneous in this process. Because this has to be real people standing up to do real things, to pass real laws, and us coming in to try to facilitate that process.
Just add one thing to what Thomas has said. One of the interesting things I think that Thomas Berry's work had on me is when he started talking about the origin, the source of rights being something other than human constitutions and human legislatures. Because if we're talking about a situation where the fundamental rights, let's say the equivalent of human rights, if the source of that is outside of the legal system, in other words, if we, and I'm using rights here in a shall we say, slightly analogous sense, Thomas sometimes expresses it as, you know, giving each its due, you know, so in the same way as now, if human rights originate, are intrinsic because we exist as human beings, then these other rights, it seems to me, logically, are also on a similar footing. And that means that it should be, if you like, ultra vires, beyond the powers of the legal system to abrogate those rights, those fundamental rights. So we can't even get into a discussion about whether we can convert them to property rights or not. We're talking about something which is more analogous to a situation where a decolonialized situation where you start off by saying, well, actually, we'll invade these countries and then we'll put down rules and govern them because we know how to govern better than they do and it'll be for their own good. Then the process of decolonization starts and the fundamental realization is what you've got to grant people is a right of self-determination. It's not really up to us to regulate the whales. The whales know how to do that. What it's up to us to recognize that we need to limit our interventions into their world to give them a right of self-determination to some extent. So I think that that's also just something that I would add to what Thomas has said.
The final question, whether the rights of nature conflicted with biblical ideas.
I'm not a theologian, so I can't give you a proper theological argument about the interpretation of the word dominion in Genesis, but I'll perhaps approach it by telling a story. You may have heard of Wangari Maathai, the Kenyan woman who founded the Greenbelt Movement and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, the year before last. And I came across her again through the Gaia Foundation, and she asked us, the Kenyan constitution was being revised, and she asked us to give some input into the revision of the Kenyan constitution, which they were using. And in the preambular statements, she then had to present these amendments to a constitutional committee and argue them. And there was a churchman on the constitutional committee, and we had used the term earth community. And he said, you know, what is this earth community stuff here that you're on about, you know? And she said, well, you know, in Genesis it said that, you know, God made the world essentially on 6 days, and then made, no, 5 days, made and then made humankind on the sixth day and then rested. Is that right? I thought so. but my catechism's a bit rusty. And she said, when we talk about the earth community, we're talking about what God did from Monday to Friday. There's no way, if one looks at God's creation, it seems to me, that one can separate out the human and say that it's okay, that God intended that to be okay, that you could destroy what he did from Monday to Friday as long as you looked after what he did on Saturday, which is humankind. And in any event, the way the system works means that one has to... that I don't believe it is possible to attain human well-being and fulfillment other than in the context of the whole community. So although I'm not a biblical scholar, I do find it difficult to accept an interpretation of Genesis which would understand dominion to include the right to destroy the rest of creation.
You heard first Cormac Cullinan, author of Wild Law, A Manifesto for Earth Justice, followed by Democracy School founder Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, CELDF.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude the program with the presentation of Winona LaDuc from the 2008 Symposium of the Center for Earth Jurisprudence. Winona LaDuc is an Anishinaabe environmentalist, economist, and author who lives and works on the White Earth Reservation and is the founding director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project. In 1996 and 2000, she was the Green Party vice presidential candidate. Winona LaDuc.
Ani nindwe magenetak nagagwe gitmagis vine sikwe go makwa indo dam gawa babani kagish kanagining indunjabamigwich. As you may have gathered, that's Ojibwe. From my community, about a third of the continent was named and is full of Algonquin speakers, of which my community is one. I live on the White Earth Reservation, which is in northwestern Minnesota. You all know where Minnesota is that right? Very good. I'm between Bemidji and Fargo, one of seven Ojibwe or Anishinaabe reservations in northern Minnesota, one of 19 in the United States, and one of about 150 between the U.S. and Canada, the border not being of great significance to us, as we have predated it, as you may gather. This month, as we know it in our neck of the woods, our territory is called Anabanagizis, which I recognize is somewhat irrelevant here in Florida, but it means the hard-crusted snow moon, which is the moon when it refers to when it snows and then it thaws and then it freezes again. Conceptually, you can understand this. Good. And it's also known as the moon that one doesn't want to do a face plant in the snow. Followed quickly by maple syrupy moon and Wabaganagesis, the flower moon, Odeiminagesis, the strawberry moon, mean geesus, the blueberry moon, Monominicae geesus, the wild rice-making moon, leaf-changing color moon, Goshkodno geesus, the freezing over moon, little spirit moon, great spirit moon, sucker moon. Why did I tell you all of those moons, aside from the fact that I thought it was a good thing to introduce you to our languages that are spoken on this continent? I wanted to see if you could note that there is that we do not have a single moon which is named after a Roman emperor. See that? It is possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire. And I think that that is something that is worth considering as we think about the issues of sustainability and the law, where we are going as a society, because I'm someone that firmly believes that a society based on conquest is not sustainable. A society based on empire is not in itself. One has to figure out how to make a way of life which is in keeping with that which a lot of our speakers have spoken to, the creator's law or natural law. And so in saying that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of a multicultural legal paradigm in this millennium and ask you to consider that, although I know you are steeped in traditions that are not multicultural necessarily in terms of the law, but to ask you to think about getting out of a box and think about what that means for sustainability and the possibility that a paradigm that is not based on whether it is English common law or Catholic law or U.S. federal legal systems might be actually a paradigm that has a little bit more tenacity over the long haul. And so in saying that, I just, again, want to thank you for the opportunity of speaking with you today and also recognize the great colleagues that I'm with. I'm not a lawyer, as you may have gathered. I'm a rural development economist by training. But, the speakers this morning, I've followed their work, and in the case of Andrew, he actually helped us, or his legal counsel helped us in our case to protect our wild rice from genetic engineering and patenting, which is what I'm involved in, and I will talk a little bit about that later. But I am I feel very privileged to be here with such great legal scholars. So having said that, let me talk a little bit about the tenets of indigenous legal thinking, or indigenous thinking about sustainability, if one would call them that. We have, and I'll issue a little disclaimer, which is not unlike that which Andrew said, is that I am an Ojibwe or Anishinaabe, and I know the most about my own legal, political, social, spiritual traditions. I'm not a Christian, which you may gather quickly in my remarks, so I know a little less about Christian paradigm, but I will tell you that I don't know all things about all indigenous people, which is really important to acknowledge, because sometimes when one is considered a scholar, people say, well, what do the Indian people think about that? And I say, well, what do the white people think about that? You know, there's kind of a wide array of thinking. You know, and it is very important not to oversimplify people's paradigms or people's histories and to recognize the complexity and diversity that exists. So having said that, let me talk a little bit about indigenous thinking about the law and sustainability, but I'm going to talk from my own Anishinaabe Moan, my Anishinaabe vantage point. But I think that, from that which I know, from whether it is the Inuit or, you know, indigenous people in South Africa and elsewhere, there's a lot of resonance in these teachings. So foundationally, indigenous legal and social institutions, political institutions, governance institutions, and spiritual institutions are founded on a set of precepts. In our own Anishinaabe tradition, we call this Gichi Tibwewin, or the Great Law, the Creator's Law. It is our perception that the Creator's Law is higher than the laws made by nations, states, or municipalities, and one would do well to live in accordance with the Creator's Law, to understand that we are the last ones to have arrived here in our own creation story, which is different than a Judeo-Christian set of teachings. In our own creation story, we're the last ones to arrive, and all our older relatives is who taught us how to live. In our teaching of what is Gichi Tibwewin, or the Great Law, there are many elements of that teaching. One fundamental element is Anishinaabe A King, which is means the people's land. Anishinaabe is how we call ourselves, A King is the land. But in our teaching as Anishinaabeg people, and I think it is prevalent in many other indigenous cultures, the concept of private property does not exist. And in fact, what there is the people's land does not have the same dominion construct as comes out of European law. In our perception, we belong to the land. The land does not belong to us. Anishinaabe Aking, the people's land. And in that, our understanding of the land is reaffirmed through our relationship, through our practice, through our spiritual teachings, through our feasting, our ceremonies, our dancing. They say that one of the differences between perhaps indigenous spiritual teachings and our practices and Judeo-Christian and other religious institutions, I heard a scholar say this, and I'm not sure you can all consider this, they referred to those other teachings as commemorative religions, and that many of the holidays and the practices are based on commemoration of a series of very significant events in those teachings. In our religious practice, it is referred to, our spiritual practice, we're referred to as reaffirmation religions. And that which we do, whether it is our feasts with each ceremony, our ceremonies, our sun dances, our Madewin, I'm a member of the Madewin, that we reaffirm our relationship to all of creation that is there, and our seasons and that which the Creator has given us. And we reaffirm our relationship to place, because in itself, that is one of the sacredness of place is one of our most significant teachings. So let me just give you a brief example of this, and then I'm going to talk a little bit later about a contrast. In our territory, in Anishinaabe Aking, there is a place known as the place where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east. The thunder beings rest. It is a mountain upon which we as Anishinaabeg observe that the thunder beings would pause and reaffirm their relationship to the water and to the land. And we observe that. This is called the place where the thunder beings rest. And it is today known as, it's near the city of what is known as Thunder Bay in Ontario and Lake Superior. And that is where that name came from. This is observation of the relationship between the creation, the different levels of creation. I'll tell you that because I'm going to tell you how that is contrasted in this society. But that is an example of how we recognize the sacredness of our land and the sacredness and the relationship between the spirit that is there, the great spirit, and the animate nature of our land itself as these places that are sacred. We have a teaching of Nindawe Muganatuk, which is, in English, we would say, we are all related. That is our teaching. Which is to say that in our story, as Anishinaabeg people, when the original woman came down to the earth, she came to the back of the great Mi'kmaq, the great turtle, upon which she landed. And there the other animals were swimming around, and she realized that she had to have land upon which to sustain herself. And so she asked the great creatures to help her get the land from the bottom of where the flood had come. And so the very charismatic megafauna went to try to get this, you know, first the loons, and then the otters, and the bears, the big guys, big important guys. None of them could get the earth from down in the deep of the water. It was Wajashk, the muskrat, is who could. And went down to the bottom and came up with, in his little paw, he had this earth. And then she took that and she spread it out on the turtle's back, which is why they call this Turtle Island here in our teachings. And in spreading that out, that is how this land was formed. And I told you that because in that teaching of Nindawe Muganatuk, we are taught that even the most kind of pitiful creature, you know, arguably a muskrat is not a very fancy guy. You know, that we are totally, not only are we related, but we are fortunate that the muskrat risked his life for us. And so it teaches us a reverence, you know, for our relatives, even if they aren't big and fancy guys. You know, that is what we are taught. We are taught in our indigenous legal paradigm or our spiritual paradigm that all things which are natural are cyclical. The moons, the tides, the seasons. Even our bodies themselves. In some teachings, we talk about that the four spirits of water include also, besides the water that falls, the water that is under the earth, they refer to the water that is in our bodies as a part of this whole cycle, that is not separate, that we as humans are related to this natural world. And many of these people talk about how we are related to the cloud beings in that same practice, in that same understanding, that we are not separate, but that all things which are natural are cyclical. We have a teaching that most things are alive. That is to say, in my language, and if language determines your thought and your reality, the word asin, the word for stone, is an animate noun. What does that mean? They call them the grandfathers when we go in our sweat lodge. Our grandfathers. Because they were here a long time ago and they witnessed all that is. Our words for wild rice, most of our relatives are animate. But then, I'm not really sure why, the word odaban, the word for car, is also animate in our language. You know? That is to say, how does a people adapt one's language to changes in technology? We describe a car as being animate. You know? I don't know. But does that change how you perceive the world if your language refers to the world in terms of animate nouns? Yeah. I think it does. There's a different worldview. Is it any less valid than the English language? No. It is standing in its... And in that, we understand that those relatives have standing on their own, much to the discussion this morning. We understand that, that they all have standing and have spirit. And in as such... we have this teaching of reciprocity. That's how anthropologists call it. I don't know really the word in Ojibwe. I'll have to work on that one. Which means that recognizing that they all have standing, whether it is wild rice or whether it is a sin, a rock, whatever we harvest, it has standing, it has spirit. So when I go harvest wild rice, Manoman, in Manoman Akegizis, the wild rice making moon, I go out on a lake. I don't know if you know this. That's where wild rice comes. It comes from lakes and rivers. Only place in the world it grows is in Anishinaabe Aking in our territory. Only grain indigenous to North America. And we go out and we offer our prayers, our sema, our offerings when we go out to harvest our wild rice. And then we go out on a lake. My son is 17 and pushes me out in a canoe. Two sticks, a canoe, two people, a second one with a pole to push you out on the lake. That's how we harvest our wild rice. We're totally intermediate technology people. And we go out there and we offer our thanks for that rice giving itself to us. And we have an understanding, which is that we take only what we need and we leave the rest in all of our harvests. And anthropologists refer to this practice of reciprocity, where we give when we take. We have a Thanksgiving feast and we always offer prayer. We always have Thanksgiving. We have songs for all our harvests too, you know. And I'll tell you the truth, I'm not a very good singer. It's funny, I have to sing for this maple syruping when I go back. We're starting syruping. I have to sing. And my Madewan elders, they said, no, we're giving you a new drum. I said, will that help me sing better? You know, and I said, no, you have to have a new drum. I said, I'm going to pray hard, I can sing better. But we do that, you know, and anthropologists refer to that as this reciprocity. But those are all teachings. And then we have this teaching, which I think is very essential to these discussions about the law. And this actually is best articulated perhaps in the Iroquois Confederacy. What this teaching is that in each deliberation, we consider the impact upon the seventh generation from now. That's the teaching. In each deliberation, we consider the impact on the seventh generation from now, the ones who have not yet arrived. You know, that they also have a right to be considered in our deliberations. And that is our teachings. We have a covenant, that is the term we will use with the Creator, which is Minobamatasiwin. It's an agreement that we practice, which is, you know, essentially to say that which you know, which is And I'm not a big proponent of natural resource management or these other terms, because we are not really, it is not about managing creation. It's about managing our behavior. You know, because, you know, wolves and salmon don't cause extinction of species. That's us. You know, and so this agreement is Minobamata Siwin, or the good life. How one leads this life is based on these set of teachings. In our framework, in our understanding of the world. And that's been pretty good for 10,000 years or so. You know, we thought it worked out pretty good. And I think that it is important to acknowledge that, because I know as well, you know, I've been around a little while here. I am fully aware that that indigenous legal paradigm is not considered valid in most legal institutions in this country. It is viewed as folkloric. It is viewed as something which is of the past, of having little relevance, something of a people who have chosen not to progress in the same way. You know? And it is really important to ask you to consider your own set of values in your own paradigm, and if you are willing to accept knowledge that is exterior to the knowledge systems which you've been indoctrinated with, if it is possible that there are other worldviews that have validity as well. You know, and I bring this up because my legal colleagues on this panel, and I don't know if you know this, but you know, 30 years ago, September of 1977, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I ended up at the first UN meeting on the rights of indigenous people, the United Nations. Indigenous people had tried to get into the UN for a number of years, saying we are also nations under the law. We have common language, territory, governing institutions, economic institutions, histories. We have a right to be recognized as people of full human rights and standing, not as individuals, but as collective groups of nations, whether they are the San, you know, Aboriginal people of Australia, the Maoris, Anishinaabe. We have predated the colonial legal institutions and the colonial states which exist today. We've predated, but we have never had a voice at the United Nations. And so for many years, the Iroquois Confederacy and others went and said, we would like to come in here too to have this discussion. We believe we should be here. You know, but they were turned away. So in 77 was the first UN conference on the right of indigenous people, on the rights of indigenous people. And I attended that as a sophomore in college. I had the privilege of attending that and watching the beginning of that discussion at the United Nations. And I will tell you that it took 30 years. But in September of 2007, 30 years later, the UN passed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The United Nations passed, the General Assembly passed the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, our rights to self-determination, our rights to language. But I will tell you also that four countries opposed it. You want to guess who? United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. So when we talk about where the rights are and how that weighs out, remember that we are not all on the same page on this. You know, African nations recognize the rights of indigenous peoples, but the United States does not. So that is part of your challenge, I believe, you know. I will make the argument to you that I think that the others have made as well. You know, essentially that the present industrial legal paradigm has nothing to do with those tenets that I talked about. I don't know the origins, you know, but I will say that instead of perceiving that the Creator's law is the highest law, we live in a society which believes that man's laws are the highest laws. We could trade pollution credits, change allowable recommended daily allowances of contaminants, you know, change CO2 levels, and somehow feel that we are above the Creator's law. That's what we do in this society. Now, some people say that that came actually from the Catholic Church. I don't know. This is a Catholic institution. But I will tell you that for many years, indigenous people, most recently the Oglalas of Pine Ridge, have asked the Catholic Church and the Pope to withdraw the papal bulls of 1493, which declared us inferior to people who were Christian. because in the precept that some people have higher rights than others because they are Christians, we have some foundational problems in perceptions of the law. And to the extent that English common law and American law came from that colonial law, because the Catholic Church was certainly between a handmaiden and a driver of colonialism, one has to recognize that those legal institutions in themselves deserve some challenging. You know, and in 2003, the Oglala people asked the Pope to withdraw those papal bulls. And indigenous people are still requesting the same. Instead of believing that our land is full of thunder beings, that mountain near Thunder Bay, the mountain where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east, is called Mount McKay, which illustrates one of the pet peeves I have with America, which is the naming of large mountains after small men. McKay and himself, nothing about, but you know, we got a whole continent named after these guys. Now, what possessed people to believe that we could name something as immortal as a mountain after something as mortal as a human? You know, what kind of worldview is that? And it's some guy who blows through, and most of those guys are not good guys. You know, Harney Peak in the middle of the heart of everything that is the Black Hills of South Dakota, named after a guy who led massacres of Lakota people. You know? I don't even want to start it on your presidents. I mean, you know what I'm saying is it's very important to recognize, but I'm asking you to consider it because from an indigenous perspective, this is the Holy Land. These mountains are sacred. This land, Oma'a King, is a sacred land to us. When one names or renames places after something as mortal as a human, what does that do to our perception of land? And is it possible to deconstruct? My colleague from South Africa knows it is. You know, remember that country, Rhodesia? That was named after that one guy who was a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, he had a whole country named after him, not even a mountain. You know, Zimbabwe. Ayers Rock in Australia? It's not called Ayers Rock anymore. It's called Uluru. You know, Mount Denali up in Alaska used to be Mount McKinley, right? It is possible to rename and re-acknowledge that place may have something which is exterior to a 40-year lifespan of a man, might have a bigger spiritual meaning. But I think it's important when you all consider the legal paradigm that is the United States and Canada. Instead of believing that we are all related, we have a system of natural resource management based on single species. You know, done it quite well. You know, we've moved from the biological diversity of the Great Plains of 250 different species of grass. Single largest loss of biodiversity in North America is the Great Plains, and today you've got a good portion of the Great Plains, which is a single crop. You know, monocrop, owned and patented by Monsanto. You know, that is single species management. That is the absence of a broader view, you know, by any construct. And I would not make an argument that that is sustainable. The Irish potato famine should have taught us that. You know, instead of believing that the world is animate, we have this Lockean utilitarian view in this society. Water rights would be the best example of that, perhaps. The allocation and over-allocation of Western water basins based on utilitarian use. Who cares how much water's in the river? You know, if they need it for a power plant, they will allocate it. And the beneficial use, that is the term, would not be for a fish. You know, it would be for an industrial user. That would be this idea that we have moved towards. And our whole language, language used in the United States, it is no longer even, you know, corn is an animate noun, it is agricultural resources. I spend a lot of time arguing over trees in northern Minnesota and a forest, which is a different you know, intonation than to say timber resources or board feet. So it is important, I think, in itself to recover the language and to acknowledge how the language is used, you know, in Orwellian policy and in a worldview. Instead of the construct of cyclical thinking, we have a society which is based almost entirely on linear thinking. Progress, westward expansion, the idea of a frontier is a linear construct. You can always move someplace else. The grass will be greener. No accountability for where you were. Just keep moving. Very American. Very American. And very dangerous. Ecologically and in terms of a social construct. The West is indeed a state of mind, as is the frontier, and it turns out we've run out of places to put our flag on, to conquer, or to mine. You know, kind of running out there. You know, and at some point we got to come to terms with the fact that we cannot think in the linear way. The best examples, perhaps, of a linear economic and production system and a social system are that what are two of the biggest growth industries in the United States? First, waste management. That would be a linear worldview. We take natural resources, we put labor and capital with them, and we create junk that we throw away. They're saying that what we just produce, 99% of it within about 3 months, we turn into garbage. That would be what we managed to do quite well. And in terms of social production of waste, that would be the prison industrial complex in this country. We've created an industry which is based on a linear way of thinking where we create waste of humans. And we are the best at it. So of the 9 million prisoners in the world, 2.1 million are in the United States. Not exactly an attribute of a society based on either human rights or sustainability, I would argue. When we create wastes and we create an industry which profits on it, and we create a situation where rural areas vie for prisons, and we warehouse human misery, you know. I just read today, or I don't know, it was on the news flash. It used to be 1 out of 140 Americans were in prison. It's now down to 1 out of 100, is what they're saying, or involved in the prison industrial complex in some unfortunate way. My reservation is full of it, you know. Young men in my community, if you're between 18 and 25, you've got basically, you know, three chances. One is go in the military, two, go to prison, or three, pray that neither of the other two happened to you, you know, and you are still around. It's, you know, they're saying up to half of our kids are involved in the prison system, you know, and that is not what one should aspire to as a society, is to have such a high level of incarceration. And then the idea of reciprocity, we don't have that. That is not what Orlando looks to be like. Taking only what you need and leaving the rest. I don't know how many wetlands have been allocated for other species, you know. But taking only what you need and leaving the rest would not be clear-cutting, would not be paving. You know, none of that is that practice. And the idea of the seventh generation from now, that is not our natural resource or our public policy at all. We've gone from management, perhaps, over a political term to management of a fiscal year. And I've done a lot of work on climate change, and I do a lot of work on biodiversity. And I remember the look on it happened even in my community, but talking to politicians about climate change and about how we need to cut our carbon. You see this kind of like flash go across their eyes or, you know, whatever their face. And what they're thinking is that that's not going to happen while I'm in office, is it? You know? That's what they're thinking. They're thinking, I'm not going to be holding that bag. you know. So I'm just going to keep combusting. I'm going to approve those permits because that's the next generation that's going to have to deal with it. So that is the challenge we face, you know, or elements of it. I don't have exactly a set of solutions. I have some questions, though, you know, which are based on, first of all, the idea of asking you, you know, as legal scholars, as law students, to think outside your box and to say, is it possible that legal paradigms which are not Judeo-Christian, English, or American may have some validity? What do they teach us about sustainability? You know, how could they help us be a better society? To recognize that the issues that we are talking about in this period now, we have a shot at doing something about. You know, Alice Walker talks about how we are the people who have the ability to save a river, to keep a mountaintop from coming off, you know, to clean up something that is wrong or to stop the temperature from rising 4 degrees. We're the ones. It's not somebody later on, it's us. So what higher human calling could there be, you know, than to do something of that significance for the natural world? It's not an abstract discussion. It's a real discussion, and it's, you know, I think Andrew was talking about it, the idea of, you know, the law should actually be relevant. What would be the point of continuing a discourse which has no relevance to reality, you know? Why would one want to involve oneself in a lifetime of irrelevance if you could do something that is relevant? These institutions are also, the legal institutions are not separate from the social and political institutions. As I said, I'm not a lawyer. I'm largely not a lawyer because I'd spend all my time getting my cousins out of jail for stupid things. I still spend an inordinate amount of time getting my cousins out of jail for stupid things because they think I'm a lawyer. But, you know, the public policy arena is moving in all of these areas. So in my own community, the issues I work on are climate change and the issues of biodiversity. And our Anishinaabeg people, when we were told that the University of Minnesota wanted the right to genetically engineer wild rice, they asked this question, which was, who said they could do that? Interesting question. Who said someone could change the DNA sequence? He said, did Nana Bougiou say that they could do that? Did the Creator say they could change the DNA sequence of our race? You know, I had to explain this to our people. You know, and we couldn't conceptualize it. I think it's a worthwhile question to ask. You know, who gave them the right to disregard natural law or the Creator's law? Who gave them the right? And how do we bring this legal system back in keeping with some kind of sanity? You know, in our own community, we pass ordinances on genetic engineering. You know. Those are challenging in the era of Monsanto's dominance. But our tribe said we don't want genetically engineered wild rice. We don't want it in our territory. We don't want our rice used for genetic engineering. And more, our tribal communities are exercising their tribal jurisdiction to pass similar ordinances. I was reading this interesting book. I don't know if you've seen this. It's from South Africa, that's why I was. It's an African book. Biopiracy and Biodiversity, Global Exchanges and Closure. But again, similar to, was it our lunch discussions or our some banter we had? A number of African nations are looking at model legislation on the protection of rights of local communities, farmers, breeders, and for the regulation of access to biological resources. In other words, who has a right to patent or not patent the genetic diversity of those countries? Who has a right to own the seeds? Not coming from the United States, but coming from Africa. And coming from our indigenous communities. New Mexico Seed Sovereignty Declaration passed last year by the New Mexico legislature, similarly recognizing the rights of indigenous people and farmers, Indo-Hispanic farmers, to their corn. And that corn and the continuation of that corn is an inherent right. Another set of legal paradigms which I see forwarded is the environmental rights for future generations. And that is to say, when I ran for the office of Vice President of the United States, one of the major concerns of my community was the idea of this seventh generation amendment to the U.S. Constitution, saying that in the Constitution and subsequently its amendments, there's a preservation of the rights to private property. You should not be have your private property seized. But there's no corresponding protection of common property. And as such, the commons have been enclosed by private interests, whether in the genetic sphere or in the sphere of water. And so there is a movement which has evolved since that time, which is now a fundamental rights of future generations. A future generation amendment to the Constitution. And it's coming out of Science and Environmental Health Network and International Human Rights Clinic at Harvard. But these ordinances, there's some state ordinances, but they've been passed in San Francisco, a form of this, and by a number of our indigenous communities. The responsibility of this generation to care for the generations who have not yet arrived. This is what we are discussing. And that ranges from the precautionary principle, the idea that just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. And you better guarantee to this generation and the generations ahead that it is safe before you are allowed to bring that technology or that choice into this world. To this state and national set of legal paradigms around the rights of future generations. So, in closing, we were discussing this whole in closing part. But in closing, what I would say is that I'm going to ask you to think about that those teachings that we have, the Skitchi Dibwewin, the teaching that we are related, the teachings that this land, Oma'a King, we belong to it, it does not belong to us. That it is sacred in itself. That we are a part of a set of cycles and in a world which is full of life that is not necessarily human. That those teachings in themselves have validity in the discussion on where we are going with the law. And in the richest and most powerful and arguably most dangerous country in the world, it is incumbent upon us to somehow restore or create a legal paradigm which has some relevance to sustainability. Because in the end, no matter how rich you are or poor you are, no matter if you're a lawyer or an economist or a rice harvester, you got to drink the water. Got to breathe the air. And we're the only ones who can ensure that those who aren't here yet, whether they have wings or fins or hooves or feet, are going to be able to do that. Miigwech, meet you. Thank you for your time.
Winona LaDuc, founding director of the White Earth Land Recovery Project, speaking at Framing an Earth Jurisprudence for a Planet in Peril, a symposium at the Center for Earth Jurisprudence. February 2008. You can find the center at earthjuris.org. And all episodes of Unwelcome Guests can be found archived as MP3s at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle. Oh.